Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A little after noon yesterday, the conservative activist Charlie Kirk was killed on the campus of Utah Valley University. He was in one of those shade tents that he sets up for these events at college campuses. He's done dozens of these. And the setup was pretty straightforward. Kirk invited people to debate him on any issue they can come up with. The concept is even branded on those tents. It says, "Prove me wrong." Kirk spent a few minutes working the crowd, throwing out Make America Great hats. He had just settled into his exchange when he was shot. Authorities believe from several hundred yards away, a campus building called the Losi Center. There was security footage and some phone cameras that captured what seemed to be the shooter laying on the roof of a building and then running away. Two people were initially taken into custody, but they've been released, so the hunt for Kirk's killer is still underway. Law enforcement officials, including an FBI agent, held a press conference this morning. They confirmed Kirk's killer is still at large, but they had recovered the weapon apparently used in the attack, a high-powered bolt-action rifle. They've also found in a wooded area near campus a footprint, a palm print, the impression of a forearm, they think. Many people are calling in tips as well. Governor Cox said that it was a tragic day for the country. He also said it was a dark day for the state. The governor was determined, that's probably the way to describe it, adamant that the killer would be caught, and that he reminded people that we have the death penalty in the state. That gives you a sense of sort of how the governor was thinking. He called this clearly a political assassination. So today in the program, we are talking about the story, what happened. We'll talk about the consequences now to the degree we can, what it means that it happened here in Utah. Joining us on the program, Caroline Ballard is with us. She's KUER's assistant news director. She's been covering the story. And Caroline, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Emily Anderson Stern. She's a statewide reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She was there on the campus of Utah Valley University yesterday when this happened. And Emily, welcome to you.
Thanks, Doug.
I guess, Emily, let me just sort of start with that point that you were there. Can you just tell us what happened?
Yeah, so I had initially gone to write about the event in general, and that, Utah elected leaders' ties to Charlie Kirk, especially U.S. Senator Mike Lee, and his pull to some of the young people in the state. So I was there standing in the crowd among some of the students who'd attended. And I will say the attendees had – there was a wide range of political beliefs. You know, there were some students there who were just curious, yeah, fascinated by this figure they'd seen on social media coming to campus. There were some who listened to all of Charlie Kirk's podcasts. And then there were others there to protest, provide counter-messaging.
Signs and right, things like that, sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was standing in the crowd. There were – different groups of students around me, and I was watching the crowd mostly for their reactions, because that's what I'll do a lot of times at political events I'm covering, right? I'll listen to the speaker, see how the crowd is reacting to their message. And after, you know, his events are typically in a question-answer debate format.
Yeah.
So in the second series of questions, an attendee was asking about mass shootings, and as he was answering, one gunshot rang out.
Yeah.
I didn't see what had happened because I was looking at the crowd,
yeah,
right? But just everyone dropped to the ground.
Sure.
There were screams. There was a woman right behind me who just immediately started screaming, "Where's my son?" And, you know, as soon as I looked back at the table where Charlie Kirk had been sitting, he was gone.
Yeah.
He'd been carried away. And right after that, it was essentially chaos. People started screaming, running. Some formed a prayer circle.
Wow.
But I started I initially was not sure if it was real, right? We were on a college campus. Some of the students had signs that were essentially memes trying to troll Charlie Kirk. I thought maybe this was like a demonstration because Charlie Kirk has spoken a lot about the Second Amendment, gun rights. Then I saw police officers coming in with their hands on their weapons. And I realized, okay, this is real. Something happened. You know, immediately they started pushing people out of the courtyard. A lot of people were very emotional.
Sure.
As I started talking to eyewitnesses, many of them had seen what happened and were clearly very shaken by it.
Let's say a little bit about that. I mean, we're in an era now when everyone has a phone and everyone has a camera. So there's plenty of very graphic footage that's out there that made its way into social media and posts almost immediately. Very graphic, as I said. It did seem, as an observer back here, like it was utter chaos. I mean, that's the word you used. And that sense of collective awareness of what had actually happened, was that the sense that you were having?
There were multiple people, some people who even saw what had happened thought that it was a prank at first.
Yeah.
Like they thought that maybe it was fake blood or something like
wow.
that. And so I think people were mostly in shock and no one could really agree on what they had seen or what might have happened.
Caroline Ballard, you made your way down there after it happened, obviously, to cover the aftermath of all of this. My question was, as you were leaving, how are you even going to get on campus? So what was your sense of what it was like at that moment?
Right. So I heard about the shooting here at the station. News director, Elaine Clark, sort of came rushing in just at the very first word we had. I think it was maybe about 2:30 that things sort of started to get out that there had been that Charlie Kirk had reportedly been shot. And so we just sort of went into scramble mode. I came out of the station, ended up picking up Sage Miller, who a former political reporter here, is now a producer at NPR. And we made our way down there together. And, you know, it's about a 45 to 50 minute drive from the station here at KUVR down to the UVU campus. And so as we were going, as we approached and got, you know, maybe within about 15 minutes, I noticed that cars passing us were undercover cop cars turning on their lights,
yeah.
like one after the other, and saw probably three or four of them coming by us, behind us at first. And, you know, I pulled over and three of them rushed by undercover cop cars. So as we approached campus, they were waving everyone away. We ended up parking in a church parking lot that was adjacent on the other side of the campus and ended up just walking. You know, I think we had our press badges that
yeah.
was able to get us close. There was a lot of confusion about where the media was supposed to go. So we ended up walking around this huge parking lot. First they said, go towards the baseball fields.
But just confirming the idea that it was quite chaotic.
Yes, and once we got there and once we were on campus and we started to see, you know, there were still some students milling about. There were still people who had clearly been at the event. And while we were there trying to figure out where to go, we just started to see platoons of law enforcement
yeah.
coming up, 20 at a time in tactical gear, pulling up. We saw Draper PD all from all different places in the valley, immediately getting out with rifles and tactical gear and just basically starting to swarm the campus.
Did you have a sense that it was still kind of, I'm not sure if this is the right terminology, but an active shooter situation? Because there was clearly some confusion early on that, oh, they got the guy. Now, it turned out to be a person that's familiar to Salt Lake City, a man by the name of George Zinn. He's a sort of notorious gadfly, comes to all of these kinds of events. He was arrested and there were pictures of him that were posted. There was some sense that, oh, it's been resolved. They got. So what was your sense of how the story was playing out in that way?
Yeah, so Charlie Kirk was shot at 12:20 p.m. and the police presence just kept getting larger and larger and larger. And it didn't start to kind of shrink until they had a news conference that the governor came to at 4 p.m. And, you know, I spoke to some – I kept seeing SWAT officers from various agencies throughout Utah coming in tactical gear, heavily armed. And I was told that they were searching the campus room by room. In fact, I was speaking to a firefighter from Orem who was there. You know, firefighters were there kind of watching the scene there in case, you know, something happened and they needed to help out. And they were actually pretty frustrated that messaging had gotten out about George Zinn, because I never at any point throughout the day had an officer say that they had someone in custody who they thought was the shooter, and they felt that messaging was being spread, including by the university, that made people think the situation was over. But it was an active scene for hours afterward. They still have not found the shooter. In fact, I was told by firefighters as I was waiting for a media staging area, which, as Caroline said, took quite a while for them to set up, that I was there at my own risk and they considered the area dangerous. And so I should be vigilant as I was standing there waiting. And, you know, a number of people who I talked to who were part of the response were actually extremely frustrated at communication throughout the response and at organization.
I was rather shocked at how easily we walked onto that campus. And I would say I never heard. This is the first I'm hearing that they still considered it active. I think it was so fluid, and especially afterwards, sort of seeing maps of where the media staging area was, and like I said, sort of we had a badge and some equipment, but we just kind of came right on. And that was pretty surprising to me, and surprising now to hear that, that they still consider that an active. That was not messaging that I would say even all of the media got.
There was a sense last night at the news conference where the governor spoke that they had the guy, that they someone was in custody. Kash Patel of the FBI had mentioned that and seemed quite certain of it. But now both suspects, I'll put that word in inverted quotes, have been released. So there was seemed to be a bit of confusion about that early on.
Right. And it was interesting because the news conference, you know, around 20-ish minutes after FBI Director Kash Patel was saying, we have the suspected shooter in custody. Actually, the folks who were in charge of the investigation were kind of – they. We're not trying to oppose what he was saying, right? But they were also saying, well, we just have a person of interest and we're trying to determine if they're involved with the shooting. They did not want to be as committed to what Patel was saying. And then, as you mentioned, that turned out to be untrue.
So what do we know now? It sounds like they don't know who this person is. They have clues, as I mentioned earlier. Some prints, some sense, but what are they saying about clearly no one can derive a motive yet. I mean, but what do we know right now about this person?
Not much. From the news conference this morning, we know they're looking for a college-aged male. And like you said, they have some partial prints, a footprint impression, a forearm impression, and they have reportedly recovered a weapon.
Yeah.
So they're still looking. I think there's been so much back and forth on whether where things are going. So I think there's still a lot up in the air. I know that law enforcement is actively asking for all of these videos. I mean, we live in this age where everyone has a camera, and these kinds of events that Charlie Kirk put on, I mean, they were made for social media. Yeah. They were made for dissemination.
People were rolling.
Yeah. And so I know they're asking for all of these kinds of videos, and not to mention all of the security footage that the university has. So I know that that's going to take some time to come through.
I will say, I mentioned earlier that this came as he was responding to a series of questions about mass shootings.
Yeah.
And last night at the news conference that Caroline and I were at, I asked, have you identified who asked those questions? Have you asked them any questions? Because for me and to the people who are there that I talked to, there was a sense like, was this linked? Was that was it planned that that person would ask those questions and then someone would shoot him? And we really have no indication from law enforcement if they've spoken to that person or identified who they were.
Do we know, was Charlie Kirk's family here with him? Does anyone know that? I haven't seen that reported. I think it's interesting. The vice president, J.D. Vance, is coming to Utah today. He's going to be with Charlie Kirk's family in Salt Lake City. So I guess that implies that the family is here now, whether they were there. Do we know?
I think it's a theme of the last 24 hours is conflicting information and unclear information. At the press conference yesterday, Governor Cox mentioned something about that – police officers were sent to their door. I don't know if he knew that. And now, of course, Vice President Vance is coming. I've seen reports unverified by us here at KUER. I mean, this is a fluid news situation.
Yep.
That they were in the crowd. But like I said, Governor Cox sort of linked something that would have implied the opposite.
Right. And the Salt Lake Tribune has also not gotten confirmation of that. I will say a lot of the messaging around his family has come from Charlie Kirk's political organization, Turning Point USA.
Right.
And they were waiting to confirm his death until his wife gave permission. But President Trump had posted about it prior to Turning Point confirming that.
I want to ask you what you're hearing from Utah public leaders, the congressional delegation. Let me just mention, and I'll tease out one, the reaction, because we saw it already. That's Governor Cox. One of the things that he said, I mean, beyond being quite vehement about the fact that we're going to catch this person, reminding people that we have the death penalty here, sort of underlining the fact that he believed this was clearly a political assassination. But he also said, is this what 250 years has wrought on us? He says, I pray that those who hated what Charlie Kirk stood for will put down their social media and pens and pray for the family, and that all of us will try to find a way to stop hating our fellow Americans. Did that sort of characterize the kind of reaction? I mean, what do you make of that, and what were you hearing from leaders? Was it in that sort of tenor, basically?
Well, as far as Governor Cox goes, who is a Republican, the kind of messaging he's tried to own is that we should abandon political division. You know, as he was the chair of the National Governors Association, he had a campaign called Disagree Better. A lot of folks here in Utah sometimes will say that they think he sometimes stoked political division. They don't always agree that he has acted in that way. But his reaction to this seems to be along those lines, that political violence is never acceptable.
Yeah.
And obviously he was very passionate in condemning it, saying that the death penalty is still legal here in Utah.
I would say on the whole, yes, Utah leaders, especially political leaders, have been condemning the violence. The vigil at the Capitol last night that included a lot of lawmakers, I mean, you saw a lot of emotion coming out about what this meant. And I think looking at social media, though, sort of taking it off of the leaders, though, it is sort of a tale of two reactions. You get that kind of we need to disavow political violence. We need to move forward. This is a political assassination. And then, you know, on the other side, looking at places like people posting on Instagram, people posting on Reddit, you also see a real frustration about a lack of willingness to address it up to this point, and a frustration over an uneven response to gun violence.
Yeah, and I will say Utah Democratic Party Chair Brian King actually said a prayer at the vigil of the Capitol last night. But, you know, among Democrats here, elected Democrats here in the state, there have been some who have said, we've tried to address gun violence in the past. We should have done this earlier. There have been some folks who pointed out Charlie Kirk's comments on gun violence in the past, especially where there have been shootings in schools, and him saying that, you know, rights to guns need to be protected as much as possible, that the U.S. should not pass policies to make it harder to access guns.
It's Emily Anderson Stern. She is the State Watch reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Of course, Caroline Ballard, KUER's assistant news director. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the developing story of conservative activist Charlie Kirk's killing yesterday on the campus of Utah Valley University. Two people were initially taken into custody in those hours after the shooting as suspects. They've both been released. The hunt for Kirk's killer is still underway. Now we're talking also about the consequences of all of this. Joining us now on the program is David Graham. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His latest article is called The Horrifying Assassination of Charlie Kirk. David Graham, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Ollie Breland is with us. He's also a staff writer for The Atlantic. He wrote a profile last year of Charlie Kirk for the magazine. And Ollie Breland, thank you to you for being with us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, glad to be here.
Ollie, I wanted to begin with you. Well, let me actually begin with both of you. Can you just give me your initial reaction to the story as it played out? Clearly, you were thinking about this. Ollie, you had written about it. David Graham, your reflections on it and your piece, which we'll come to. But just give me your initial reactions, both of you. David, you first.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, you know, as a news reporter in America, you get this sort of, you're accustomed to the pittance in the stomach when there is a you know, an instance of public violence. And as a political reporter, we've seen so many instances like this. And you, you know, I guess there's a few things that went through my head. Like, one was just the immediate horror of the event. You're confronted with these videos of someone dying on camera, and yeah. And they're avoidable, but not easily avoidable. And they're awful to watch. I thought about the people who were there. I thought about Kirk's family. And then I thought about, you know, what happens after these, which is always, it seems like things get worse. There is acrimony. There are accusations that are going to be false. There's a lot of misinformation and disinformation. And these tend to end up in bad places. And, you know, I'm not old enough to remember the kind of major wave of assassinations in America in the 1960s. But I know enough people who have to understand that after public assassination, things get very dicey. And so I think it was an instant feeling of dread and terror.
I had similar thoughts, but I guess to avoid being redundant, the sort of also different bits ahead of it too, were like having studied and like sort of spent a lot of time engaging with Kirk's content. I was just so surprised. Like, I think that I've kind of accepted that we're in a moment of like ascending political violence. And I know that it will keep happening unless we like sort of radically shift things and get off the track that we're on. But I didn't think that it would be targeted at someone like Kirk. And maybe that was naive of me, even though he sort of is like dabbled in rhetoric that people find offensive and extreme. Relatively speaking, he was like more moderate than some of the more extreme members of the right that have risen to prominence.
Well, I actually wanted to talk to you about that because that seemed like one of the kind of essential themes from the piece that you wrote, that Charlie Kirk played this role. I mean, you described him as at least initially kind of this gatekeeper of a bridge between mainstream conservatism and extreme fringes. And the way he evolved as a figure, I mean, he almost seemed like a centrist in some, or at least certainly a conventional Republican in some way, and then moved very much to the right. And I think that I think that's an interesting kind of development, and all the more ironic or tragic in some way that this happened to him. I don't know. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, he definitely moved to the right and like sort of dabbled as this sort of bridge figure between fringe parts of the movement. But I also do want to like contextualize that like this also came in the broader right moving to the right too.
Sure.
And so like while I don't think that it is accurate to call him a moderate in like a sort of more like objective sense between like left and right wing poles compared to parts of the sort of modern right as it stands now, he was like relatively moderate. And like, I guess that, you know, if you're on the left, like, and we don't fully know the motivations or anything of the shooting right now, but like they're, you know, there are people who are considered more pernicious on the right than Charlie Kirk. And so I was surprised that someone who is, like, to his credit, like, debated people and, like, sort of prized, like, not being violent and, like, not – and sort of being civil was targeted. Even as he moved to the right, he still, like, retained that kind of core of wanting to debate people and making himself vulnerable, which is another thing that went through my mind, too, is, like, I'd been to one of his rallies and, like, it was remarkable how close you could get to him. There was, like, very clearly visible security. But it was interesting.
Well, let me read that, like, that first sentence in your piece. It begins, Charlie Cook took his seat underneath a tent. This was in the University of Montana, the tent that said, prove me wrong. It's the same setting as Utah Valley. I mean, you must have found that a little chilling, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah, you read my mind. It was eerie to, like, have been able to have thought about being in this place and, like, what this scene could look like. And yeah, I mean, to his credit, like, he was willing to debate anyone and make himself, like, very vulnerable and open. And, like, I guess that is, like, how this could have happened, unfortunately, but he would debate anyone. And there was not, like, a vetting process. I was within a dozen yards of him. Anyone could come up directly to a mic, like, feet from him, yeah, and sort of engage him in any way that they wanted to. And security was there, but, like, you can have a lot of security, but I don't know, anything can happen when there's just hundreds of people around you.
David Graham, you wrote in your piece, you called it a grim irony of this case that Kirk was appearing on a university campus, a place that's supposed to be for, you know, a setting for debating these kinds of ideas. And you called an act of violence like this an admission of defeat. Will you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, our democratic system of politics is based on the idea that we argue about things, we can disagree about things, we settle those disagreements by compromise or by voting. But you know, when you take a gun to that situation, you are acknowledging that you don't think you have power to change the conversation in another way. It is opting out of politics. It's opting out of a sort of a society. So I think it's antithetical to any of the sort of ideals of politics that I think this country has at least, you know, aspirationally subscribed to, and certainly the ones that I would want to see in a body politic.
How are you all thinking about the way you've been writing about and seeing the evolution of political violence? You mentioned, David, in your piece, you referred to Adrian LaFrance's piece from a few years ago in the Atlantic about political violence. And she wrote that the form of extremism we face is this new phase of domestic terror. It's, you know, so what do you make about what you're learning? I'm sure you're looking into the way this particular violence is sort of filtered in the. So what are you noticing about what's happening now?
It's so tricky because political violence is something that has been a staple of American history in every period, and it waxes and wanes. And, you know, even when we want to talk about, for example, frequency of political violence, it's hard to nail that down. It's hard to decide what is political and which incidents to include.
Yeah.
But certainly we have these really high-profile cases, whether it is this, it is the assassination attempts against Trump, it is the assassination, an attempted assassination of Minnesota state lawmakers. Mm-hmm. You know, you can trace this back a long way. And then you start looking into these cases, and often when we know who the shooter is, it's somebody who, you know, has an unintelligible ideology or is mentally disturbed. There's a lot of complications to it. But what we know from scholars is that these events tend to beget more violence. And I think they're a product of a time when people are really frustrated and polarized. That's a consistent pattern throughout history from scholars who've studied political violence and assassinations, as they happen when there's polarization, when there's frustration. You know, exactly the kinds of things we see going on in the United States right now.
Well, the sense of powerlessness also is something you write about, that people have figured that if they're just powerless, as you write in your piece, to stop politicians and policies that they're opposed to. So they're trying now the extreme. They're trying to kill.
Exactly. I mean, you have a sense where people are really polarized. They hate the other side as much as they have any affection for it. But because elections are so close, because the country is not just divided but closely divided, it's hard for any movement or any party to get a permanent hold on power. It's hard for change to happen. Election seems to go back and forth without a lot of change. And I think that feeds a kind of despair about traditional political methods. You see people saying the country is going on the wrong path. They don't trust leaders of either parties. They don't see a way out. And for most people, that is depressing. But for some people, that seems to lead them to try to take some other measure to change politics. And we don't know what happened yesterday. But I think that is true about many of these instances of political violence or attempted political violence.
Ollie Breland, what do you make of the reactions you're hearing and seeing? I'm thinking in particular about a really angry reaction from the president last night. Like, what do you make of all of that?
Yeah, there's like on both sides, there's two rough genres of reactions. And like one is fairly heartening. It's, you know, people condemning the violence, saying that this kind of thing is like bad, even if you disagree with Charlie Kirk. And then on the right, people kind of remembering Kirk talking about like not resorting to violence and sort of deriding it, especially in a political context. But yeah, then the less heartening bit, as you kind of referenced, is this sort of this rhetoric of retribution and retaliation that like not just the specific shooter must be held accountable, which, you know, like obviously makes sense, but that this is like a product of a larger thing on the left and that the left should be held like accountable. And that obviously raises concerns for retaliatory violence. Like that is not good. And, you know, I very much hope something like that doesn't happen. But the sort of other concern too is that this could be used as like a chip to crack down and sort of advance the encroachment of civil liberties that's kind of already been going on by the Trump administration. They've used lesser things than this. The admittedly, like, you know, sort of dangerous attack that happened on Edward Korstein, the Doge employee, which was not good, was a much less significant thing, but that was like used among other things as justification to bring federal agents into Washington, D.C. This is much more significant. And so if the Trump administration follows the pattern that it has, like this could augur not good things in terms of like constitutional crises.
Ollie, you wrote this in your piece. I wanted to ask you about it. You said to think of Charlie Kirk as only a media figure is to miss the point. That there are those who believe Kirk was the most important person in the conservative movement. So it made me – I heard Kirk described recently as irreplaceable in the movement. You know, maybe like – in the same way that you're hearing is like who would replace Donald Trump in the movement, the kind of charisma and appeal and whatever else, you know, that they have as kind of signal personality. Do you think that's right that he's – Charlie Kirk is sort of irreplaceable. And I guess what happens now to this movement, do you think?
I think that is extremely true in the way that, like, I think the term in business is like you build out a moat on a successful business. You build this like really irreplaceable product and like set of strategies. Kirk had established that for himself in politics and within the right. He was an extremely successful and like skilled like orator and influencer. His media like empire is like working quite well. But then on top of that, he also was able to build out this like sort of ground game and get out the vote apparatus to attract low propensity young voters, which you could argue was like very successful in helping Trump win. He also had a sort of like very deep Rolodex of strong relationships and was sort of seen as this like within the right wing movement, this influential figure that was like good to know, and he would campaign with people and help them fundraise, and then also had connections to the White House and was like, I think reportedly responsible for being consulted on some hires. And then he also had tentacles within the religious right movement and had established like a large presence there, which is like absolutely essential. And then even then too, he was like this bridge that didn't have a formal relationship with the far right, but like was aware of what mattered there. And I think that a single person encompassing this entire network of things doesn't exist in the way that he did. And so, yeah, it will be hard to replace him. On the flip side, he did a really good job of creating institutions that I don't fully know, but I'm curious to see and suspect that they might be able to outlast him. Like Turning Point USA seems to be robust and well-managed, and I think that can continue. So I'm curious to watch that.
David Graham, what do you imagine as being the kind of the tension we're feeling at this particular moment? Does it seem particularly fragile? Does it seem particularly volatile right now? And what do you think people need to be hearing right now from their leaders?
I mean, it does feel very volatile. It does feel very tense. I mean, it's felt that way, I think, for I mean, you can date this to January. You can date this to 2020. You can date this to 20. You know, you pick a date. So I think this escalates all of that. What political scientists who study political tension and political violence say is that leadership makes a huge difference. Even if people are upset about things, even if they have the attitude that political violence is more acceptable morally, they are less likely to act if they don't have leaders who are encouraging them. And they're more likely to act if they do have leaders who are encouraging them to take action in their own hands. And while it's true that, you know, the actual perpetrators of political violence are few, it really makes a difference what leaders are saying and whether they are trying to inflame tensions or if they are trying to knock them down. I think it's really troubling to see misrepresentation of reactions. I think it's troubling to see leaders jumping to conclusions without a lot of information. You know, the reactions that make me think that people trying to keep the situation calm and looking out for people's best interests.
That's David Graham. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Ali Breland, also a staff writer for the magazine. David's latest article is called The Horrifying Assassination of Charlie Kirk. Ali Breland also wrote a profile that we mentioned last November. We'll put a link to both of those on our website. David, Ali, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about this developing story of the conservative activist Charlie Kirk, who was killed yesterday on the campus of Utah Valley University. As we've mentioned, the kind of intensity of that experience has been reflected in the initial responses from public leaders. We reached out to Utah Senator John Curtis this morning, former Provo mayor, Orem, the UVU campus, right there in his backyard. So when we spoke with him this morning, he had a sense of real kind of personal tragedy.
For so many reasons, it's so many layers. It is so heartbreaking and just a feeling of almost gloom. Mm-hmm. I was hoping this morning I'd feel better. I guess to some degree I do, but I think it's looming over all of us.
How have you been thinking, Senator, about what it is you want to say to the people of Utah? You're a public figure. You're a public representative of the state. And I know you're probably sort of working through what is the thing you want to say now. There's probably a bit of anguish that you feel, also a sense of sadness, as you just mentioned. But how is it that you're thinking about what you want to say right now to people?
Well you know, it's interesting that you ask it that way, because between me and my team, we spent a considerable amount of time trying to articulate exactly what you asked. And the place I landed was a couple of things. One was, I think people need hope. They need to hear from me that we will be okay, that we'll get past this. I feel a personal responsibility to also add a message of my personal belief that the contempt that we're experiencing as a society is ripping us apart, and that we have to address that. I know mothers that don't speak to daughters. I know friends that no longer speak, and that is really really unfortunate, and in my opinion must change. And then I think the third component of it is I reflected on an experience I had many years ago when I attended the funeral of a very dear high school friend. And I remember thinking how bad I wanted to tell the audience at that funeral what I was thinking and feeling, so much so that I wish, right, that I could stand up at the microphone and talk. And so I actually did a little video yesterday and invited people to email me about what they're feeling, and made a commitment that I would literally read them, because I do think part of what people are feeling is they wish they could articulate to somebody that cared or would listen. And I think that's an important part of my role.
Do you think, I'm not going to ask you to comment on the tenor of other political leaders and how they're responding right now. So I want to make that clear. But I do want to ask what it is you think the people you're talking with, your constituents that you have in mind, what is it that they want to hear, do you think, from leaders? Is it a kind of, as you're talking about, hope? Is it a kind of wisdom, trying to calm the tension? Should there be a moment of kind of anguish or defiance? We're hearing a bit of that from President Trump, things like that. So what are you thinking about that?
Well, first of all, I think it's natural and that we should acknowledge, you know, everybody knows the grieving process, right? And that we should acknowledge that there will be some anger, right? We should acknowledge there will be denial, right? All the stages of grief. And I think we need to be careful in being too judgmental about how people feel in the moment. I think it's more important about how they feel, you know, several days from now and as we start to heal. And so I personally would give a lot of latitude for however people are grieving and realizing that grieving will mature. And I think as an elected official and as a leader, we all have a responsibility to now kind of shepherd and nurture that grieving in a way that moves us to more of a positive dialogue, more of a positive outcome in moving into the future.
That said, I think I wonder anyway if you are worried about, I mean, I've seen people commenting on, you know, one act of political violence begets another, and this kind of thing evolves and builds and people are sort of seeing it. I wonder if you're seeing it as us being kind of on a knife edge right now, the sense of volatility, the kind fragility.
Sure.
Are you? And I wonder if you just worry if something could crack that's even worse than the moment we feel like we're in right now.
So I do, but I think that we've been here before. And I'll point to civil rights and Martin Luther King. And I just love one of his quotes, and I'm going to paraphrase it and not get it right word for word, but he really gives us a choice. You can try to drive out hate with hate, or you can try to drive it out with love. And what a perfect example. And we're not going to drive it out with hate. We're going to have to drive it out with love. And I think if there's a space for, you know, somebody like myself to step into, it's to find the right way that I can make that message resonate. Nobody wants to be lectured to. Nobody wants to be told they're doing this wrong. But I do feel like this realization, and I'll come back to, you know, this is far bigger than just this one terrible, terrible, tragic thing. This is something that is dividing our families. This is something that's dividing friendships. And we've been paying a very, very heavy price for a long time in relationships and in our society. And, if there's some good, we always look for good, right? If there's some good that would come out of this, would be perhaps a turning point and a realization that we have to choose. Do we want to respond to this with hate? And that will only escalate, right? And that doesn't take us to a good place. Now, I know responding with love is going to be really difficult for a lot of people, right, this morning.
Well, can I key on that point?
Sure.
There's some irony in you quoting Martin Luther King here because, of course, Charlie Kirk said not terribly generous things about Dr. King. And there are a lot of people who find his opinions and some of his ideas and sort of his provocative presentation, they found that really ugly. And it's hard for them, even though they find it absolutely tragic what happened and for his family, they also are feeling conflicted about their feelings, I suppose. So how do you think about that?
Yeah, I would invite them to take a pretty deep look inside, right? Like, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, you got to look really hard inside right now.
if you're conflicted about your feelings about this. This should not conflict anybody. This, like, right, like you can say, look, I adamantly disagreed with his philosophy. I adamantly disagreed with his approach, but nobody should be conflicted with angst for what happened in one of the most peaceful parts of our state, in one of the most peaceful parts of our country. Look, my home's a couple of miles from there. We've always bragged, right, that we walk on our streets and say hi to the people we pass. We always brag that we can walk on the streets at night and feel safe. And this came right into the belly of, excuse me, Happy Valley, right? Like, yeah. I hate to use that phrase, but this went right into the heart of that and attacked it. And, like, nobody should be conflicted. Now, I'll give people a lot of generosity in their feelings of how they're dealing with this. But as they sort these things out, I just hope and plead that they don't find themselves conflicted about how they should feel about this.
Senator, let me ask finally. I want to come back to what you just said about the fact that it happened here in Utah. What do you make of that? I mean, it in some ways it could have happened anywhere. The fact that it happened here was a sort of a matter of circumstance. But I wonder if how you're if you're feeling obviously more personally sort of connected to the story, as I guess we all are here. Well, but does it say something about this, I don't know, this place in any way? How are you thinking about that?
Well, without a doubt. Look, I've been on that campus more times than I can count. I've spoken there in venues from top to bottom throughout that campus. I think of the July 4th parade just a few miles away from there, where 300,000 people come, and all of us right in that parade with no chance if somebody wanted to do us harm. And I've always said, oh, I'm okay, it's Utah, right? That's what I've always said when I'm in those situations. And I think I have to be careful too as I recalibrate that I don't, you know, retrench and say, look, I'm not going out in the public anymore, because we just simply can't do that. And I'm very curious as this unfolds and we learn about the shooter, and I think we probably will learn more and more. It would sure help me if he or she's from out of state, right, and it's not a Utah. And that would break my heart even more if this was a student or somebody from Utah, because that would shatter even further my feeling of safety and that Utah is a safe place.
I said that was my final question. Let me just throw one more in here. Forgive me.
Sure.
What happens now, Senator? You don't know. We don't know. But how are you thinking about what happens now?
Yeah, I think we need to look at that on several fronts. I think it's an immediate time for all of us to think about, you know, the two children without a father, the wife without a husband, the parents without a son, and do what we do personally in the way that we do it. For me, it's prayer, right? And for whatever it is for people, I think that is something that needs to happen. I think as we process this and come out of it, it is a time to question contempt, the political, you know, the keep ratcheting this thing up. I mean, you and I could both go through a very long list of political violence that seems to be increasing. And so the question for me is, how do we turn that, right? Like, how does that stop? And what is my role in that? And quite frankly, I think every one of us, whether we're a political leader or not, needs to look in the mirror every day and say, what am I going to do to turn the dialogue? And that can be an individual conversation with a family member, right? It can be an old high school friend that we may not be speaking to. And I think we need, you know, 1,000 acts of kindness every day from every one of us to turn this.
Am I going to see that reflected in your speeches and the, you know, town hall meetings or the language that you're offering now? Will that define some of that in some ways?
Yeah, Doug, I would hope that people have seen that in the past, and that certainly you can expect to continue to hear that from me. But I certainly wouldn't want to be accused of all of a sudden seeing this differently. And I think people that know me You know, I think if you reflect on our last interview, I've always tried to be that. Sure, I have strong opinions, but how I deal with people that differ with me, I hope that I can continue to improve, but that I've also made that a priority in the past.
Senator John Curtis, thank you, sir, very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Of course, Utah Senator John Curtis. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.